This is the State of Things live from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. You probably know who Bruce Lee is. He's the Chinese action film star who popularized martial arts movies in the 1970s. Did you also know that Bruce Lee is an icon for some African Americans? It's true, and it may be because Bruce Lee was the rare non-white leading man. Crystal Anderson is an associate professor at Elon University. She writes about the connection between Chinese and African American culture in her new book, and she's here now. Crystal Anderson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, we should find out about Bruce Lee, first of all, and how he resonated at all and became a big star in the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, he started out in terms of kind of American awareness of him in the television show The Green Hornet. He played Kato, the sidekick to The Green Hornet, although interestingly, I've been told in China they call that show the Kato Show. But it was significant because even during that time, it was rare to have a person of color on a recurring show. At the end of The Green Hornet, the story goes that producers wanted to create a vehicle just for Bruce Lee, and that vehicle was the television show Kung Fu, which ended up starring David Carradine, because as the story goes, at the end of the day, they just could not cast Bruce Lee because they did not think America was ready for a Chinese leading man. Bruce Lee takes his show back to Hong Kong and makes these 4.5. The half is the unfinished final film that he made before he died. These very small but very impactful films for people around the world, and different people take those films in different kinds of ways.
And they took off here in the United States, so they, in a sense, that the producers were wrong. America was ready for that, at least in the theaters, right?
Yes, to a certain extent. I think the popularity of Bruce Lee occurs after you have this boon of kung fu films that starts, ironically, with these art house kung fu films, A Touch of Zen, Come Drink With Me, and then kind of deteriorates later in the 1970s with the badly dubbed, badly edited kung fu films that people may be familiar with weird titles like Ninja Chastity Kung Fu.
Was that actually a kung fu film?
Or was it an actual name of a kung fu film.
Ah, maybe it's.
And people still love those, but then those films were kept alive in African-American and Latino neighborhoods and kind of second-run theaters, and then they're after Bruce Lee's death, there was this kind of steady solidification of his popularity. First, I think, among people of color, and then largely in popular culture in general.
How did that happen, and why did it happen, do you think?
I think it happened because Bruce Lee resonated with so many people. Resonated with African Americans, but also resonated with Hong Kong migrants, and also Asian Americans.
Well, and he does. He plays the underdog, of course, in these films. So we've got a clip from the film Enter the Dragon, and Bruce Lee is pitted against the powerful and the corrupt Mr. Han. Here we go.
What do you know about Han?
He lives like a king on that island, totally self-sufficient. This was a stewardess, Mary King, found floating in the harbor. Nothing unusual about a body in the harbor. But this girl was last seen at a party aboard Han's private junk. They'd reported her lost at sea before the body was found. We believe he selects attractive girls and methodically builds their dependence on drugs, then sells them to an elite clientele around the world.
What did the autopsy reveal as the cause of death?
She did not drown.
I gather you still don't have enough to bust up his operation.
We know everything. We can prove nothing. We want you to go in there as our agent. Get us our evidence.
And come out in one piece to give it to you.
Here we
go.
You
thought well.
Bruce Lee in the film Enter the Dragon, a film that also had a black martial arts artist, Jim Kelly, right?
Yes.
So tell us about, so here it is. First of all, the trope. I mean, this is an easy thing for us to get behind. Here's this guy who's going to take on this large syndicate, and he is the underdog, but he's also sort of taking up the cause of the underdog, right? Was that any part of his popularity in these other communities?
Yes. Bruce Lee consistently plays someone who defends the weaker against the stronger forces. And in Enter the Dragon, it's even more interesting in that Jim Kelly, the African-American martial artist in that film, comes from the United States after a racial incident. And so this kind of sequestered, secret martial arts tournament that takes place involves not just racial dynamics, but also national ones. In the clip that you just played, the person that Bruce Lee is talking to is a British official who cannot officially get involved in this kind of seedy transaction that's taking place on this island that Khan owns because of the relationship between Britain and Hong Kong and in that area of the world. They just can't be seen getting involved in it. So there's national as well as racial dynamics going on.
And this kind of superstructure, the way the world is held together by the owners and the elite, is actually the problem, part of the problem. So that you need somebody with the subtlety and suppleness of a kung fu artist. And by the way, I thought Bruce Lee was easier to understand than the guy who said clientele. That took me a minute. Didn't it take you? Clientele. What are you talking about? We got another clip from Enter the Dragon, and here we're going to, this is Jim Kelly now, we've just been talking about him. He actually stands up to Mr. Han and protects Bruce Lee. Let's listen.
You fought well yesterday. Your style is unorthodox, but effective. It is defeat that you must learn to prepare for.
I'll be too busy looking good.
What were you looking for when you attacked my guards?
Wasn't me.
You were the only man outside the palace.
I was outside, but I wasn't the only one.
You will tell me who else.
Mr. Han, suddenly I like to leave your island.
It is not possible.
Bull, Mr. Handman.
There you go. That's Jim Kelly, who was also an actor in the later 70s in the blaxploitation films, right?
Yes. And there's a link between kind of martial arts films and blaxploitation films. The director of Enter the Dragon also directed Cleopatra Jones in the Casino of Gold. So you have that kind of crossover. So it wasn't unusual to see Jim Kelly in a Bruce Lee film.
And this, of course, late 60s, early 70s, and throughout the 70s, how important, how explicit were racial and ethnic tensions? You talked about the fact that Jim Kelly came from, had a problem back in the States. How much a part of the films was that kind of talk?
Before he leaves, there's another scene which he, and you have to understand, Jim Kelly has a rather large afro. I call it a blocking out the sun afro. and before he leaves, he stops at his local dojo, which is completely staffed by African Americans, and they're, you know, practicing their martial arts moves. But there's all of this radical black iconography on the walls, the, you know, flag of various countries in Africa, the blue, the green and the black. And so the idea of pan-racial politics runs through these films, the idea of coalitions among groups of color. And in the United States in the 70s, you did see black radical groups like the Black Panthers interact with Asian American radical groups like the Red Guard. And so in the film, you're seeing a reflection of those kinds of interracial radical politics.
How popular were these movies within Asian American populations?
They were pretty popular because as Bruce Lee represents a kind of non-white icon, for Asian Americans, he was especially important because in the 1970s, they're dealing with the backlash from the Vietnam War. And even though there's a characterization of the Vietnamese as the enemy, when soldiers come back, they're not making distinctions between the Vietnamese and Asian Americans and various groups within Asian Americans. So the derogatory terms that they use for the Vietnamese, they use for Asian Americans of different backgrounds, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans. They're just all in that category. And so with Bruce Lee, they see a kind of icon, but it resonates for them differently.
Yeah, and of course, in the martial arts, there is the Zen-like quality, and I wonder how important any of the incipient New Age movement was to the popularity of these films or to any kind of progressive movements that may have followed.
That's hard to say, because Bruce Lee would talk about his kind of philosophy. He broke with traditional martial arts and that he would teach anyone, whereas in traditional martial arts, they, you know, would kind of give you the side eye if they weren't going to accept you as a student. And so there's the rumor that Bruce Lee was killed for that, although no one has been able to substantiate that rumor. He died for medical reasons. But he would often talk about spreading that beyond the Chinese culture, because he was very proud of it, but he wanted everybody to be able to partake.
Well, you also write about Rush Hour 2 with Jackie Chan. Now we're moving to Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker. What was their dynamic?
They kind of follow, in some ways, the interracial buddy movie, and we've had that for quite some time. It's slightly different with them, because instead of having the kind of main white character and the black sidekick, you have the Chinese character, and he's a Chinese national, he's not Chinese American, and Jackie Chan, and the wisecracking African American, and Chris Tucker.
How much of the black stereotype played a part in these movies? Because the script writing is kind of concise, so we have to work in type. Was that a big part of these films?
It was, and other scholars have talked about the way that those films, in order to get that laugh at the end, they do play on those stereotypes. Mostly they get a pass because it's members of the respective ethnic groups that make those groups and that make those jokes, and so they're funny, whereas if someone else said it, if a white person said it, we'd all be in trouble. In Rush Hour 2, this whole scene gets transported over to Hong Kong, so outside of the United States, in a different country, those dynamics play differently.
Well, let's listen to a clip from Rush Hour 2. It's set in Hong Kong, as you say. We're going to see Chris Tucker's character as kind of a fish out of water here, but not because he's black. It's interesting. It's because he's an American.
Don't be getting no attitude with me, Lee. I've been here 3 days and we ain't done nothing but work your cases. The only reason why I'm here in Hong Kong, because you said you was going to show me a good time. I'm on vacation, man, and I want some Mushu.
Mushu? You hungry?
No, Lee, not Mushu. Some Mushu. I want to see some women, man. Now stop playing dumb and show me to the shoe.
Well, okay, so we can say, yeah, this is the American, he kind of doesn't know the ways, but I mean, how important is African-American vernacular to that joke, for instance?
It's very important, because the dynamic between Tucker's character and Chan's character elicits laughter because of these misinterpretations that come from not just language, but also culture.
You know, it's interesting, as doing research for this, I remembered the Salt and Pepper series. This is Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford. So now we're talking, I think, late 60s. And I went back and I looked at the poster for the Salt. So Salt and Pepper were two cops, I think, two detectives or something, investigators. Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford. And then one sidekick. I think they had sort of symmetry in there. But the interesting thing is the first poster had the two of them and an Asian-American woman holding a gun. And this is maybe 1968 or 69. So the idea goes back quite a while.
It does. And there's a scene in Enter the Dragon that involves Jim Kelly and a bunch of women and kind of choosing. So there is this kind of recurrent kind of sexist objectification of women that goes along with this. So you talked about the stereotypes, and that's one of the stereotypes, which are two kind of traits on.
And but the idea of having two both leads as members of as people of color, how unusual was that?
That is pretty unusual. And in doing so, you bring up different kinds of dynamics. And so when Chris Tucker is in Hong Kong, almost no one ever refers to him as black. They always refer to him as Jackie Chan's American friend. You need to get your American friend out of here. And so it's really interesting that in a different context, Chris Tucker now represents the United States and not the kind of racial attributes we usually associate with him.
And yet, as we see, to make the joke, we're going to have to use African-American vernacular. We can't really do it and talk about a you can't be an American talking about your clientele and get the joke. Not
that's
in that
true.
Case. So let's bring this forward, because the interesting thing to me is the legacy of these films, and it goes straight through to The Matrix, you think?
I do think it goes straight through to The Matrix.
Tell us about it. Why is that?
The Matrix trilogy, and I take the whole trilogy as a whole, when you start going through and start counting not just the large numbers of characters who are of color, but the pairings of black and Asian characters are stupendous. There's Neo and Morpheus, Neo and the Oracle, Niobe and her Asian co-pilot. And so if it happens once, it may be flippant. But when it happens recurrently, I seem to think that there's a pattern and it means something.
Yeah, but now in this case, Keanu Reeves, definitely white, not Asian, not African-American.
No.
Right? But
Keanu Reeves is actually part Asian.
But he's presented in the movie.
Well, it depends on who's watching and how you read
right.
him. Because if you know about Keanu Reeves' previous film roles, something like Johnny Mnemonic, he's associated with technology. And other scholars have talked about this idea of techno-orientalism, where Asians are connected with technology, particularly in science fiction and futuristic films. And so,
and Kung Fu also plays a part in that film. Let's listen.
I know Kung Fu.
Show me. This is a sparring program, similar to the programmed reality of the Matrix. It has the same basic rules, rules like gravity. What you must learn is that these rules are no different than the rules of a computer system. Some of them can be bent. Others can be broken. Understand? Then hit me, if you can.
We go. There's a clip from The Matrix. Kung Fu plays a part in that scene. I mean, does it play an integral role, do you think, in the plot itself?
It does. I mean, it's one of the ways that the humans survive in the system. And the Wachowskis took great care to weave that into the plot and also in the background of the movie. They actually got Master Wu Ping to do the choreography, and he did the choreography. I don't know how old that man is, but he is responsible for a lot of the martial arts choreography that you see in films.
Is this a true lineage? Are the producers and the writers of The Matrix sort of looking back at these kung fu films, or is there something in the culture now that suggests that this is the kind of movie we should produce? This is the marriage we should produce for a film like The Matrix.
I think the kung fu factors into The Matrix in that it blends with the kind of casting that they did for the films, and also that these films occur in the late 90s. I think the first Matrix film comes out in 1999, and this is after the Los Angeles riots. And the discourse after the Los Angeles riots went something like, oh, this is the climax of tensions between African Americans and Korean merchants, where there's a whole lot of other things that go into the cause of the LA riots. But if you look at the television and media coverage of that event, that was a distinct thread that came through. So here you have a trilogy, a science fiction film, where you have not just a lot of people of color, which is unusual in the science fiction genre still, but these pairings of African Americans and Asians, and I like to call them vaguely Asian, because no one ever calls someone Chinese American or Japanese American in the films, but it is so overdetermined with Asian culture, the use of kung fu, the sites of fights, that it's in the air and in the imagination of the film.
And it's not just that we're casting these characters and finding the best actors. These are types. We want to see still these characters playing types, African-American, Asian-American.
Yes, and other scholars have said that the casting is superficial and that it reinforces those kinds of stereotypes. However, I argue that in some ways it kind of challenges those stereotypes, especially with the interaction between Neo and the Oracle, the kind of chain-smoking grandma that bakes cookies, without whom Neo can't fulfill his quest and actually free everyone else.
Does it try to smash the type, or does it play against the type? Does the joke become richer because that's not what you expected?
I'm of this mind about it. There are other people who argue that it reinforces those stereotypes.
Crystal, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Crystal Anderson, Associate Professor at Elon University. Her new book is called Beyond the Chinese Connection, Contemporary Afro-Asian Cultural Production. And this is the state of things. Coming up next, we'll get a chance to talk with our band today, Lowland Hum, and you will get a chance to hear them right now. Stay with us.
A silver tone pierced a stark still night. The clapper struck the bell with thunder. echoes fill the